More than 10 years ago, Neil Howe and William Strauss wrote The Fourth Turning. It's an American prophecy, what the cycles of history tell us about America's next rendezvous with destiny. Nearly 10 years ago, I'm holding a work in my hand right now, what that prophecy has been and how you see it unfold today is absolutely riveting. In a moment, Neil Howe joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Neil Howe is a historian, economist, author, founding partner of the consulting firm Life Course Associates. He's spoken and written extensively on the collective personalities of today's generations, who they are, what motivates them, and how they shape America's future. His current titles include Public Policy Advisor to the Blackstone Group, Senior Advisor to the Concord Coalition, and Senior Associate to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And he's with us tonight to talk about generations, how they shape history, as well as a 20-year cycle of crisis facing the U.S., as predicted in his book, The Fourth Turning. Neil Howe. Neil, how are you?
Great, George.
Good to have you with us. Nice job with the book, along with William Strauss, but came out more than 10 years ago, the first edition, yet the things that are in it today are coming home to roost, Neil.
Well, 1997 is when it came out, and of course, that was a time when the things were looking brighter. You remember that was the dot-com bubble before the bust?
Yep.
But we were looking down the road, and the prediction we made of a fundamental change in the social mood in America was predicted for the next decade. And we made that prediction on the basis of how old the various generations were at the time and sort of where we saw the time at which we predicted that this generational aging would sort of push us over into the next stage, the next phase of the mood and the kind of the social cycle that we see throughout much of our history.
Neil, tell us about generational history. What does it mean, and how do you know how to discover these cycles in between?
Well, that's a great question. A generation is a group of people born over a certain period of time, usually about 20 years or so, the length of a phase of life, you know, but the time that passes between being born and coming of age as an adult. And we locate generations by looking at groups which have attitudes and behaviors in common. We can, you know, look at data and see commonalities that way. That have a certain common self-identification. Today, you can go out and ask people what generation they think they belong to. And also, very importantly, to share a common age location in history. A generation is a group of people that feel they participate in some era of our history in their childhood, and then a subsequent era, coming of age into adulthood. And a couple of good examples of this are the famous GI generation. You know, we know them as the greatest generation. Those are the Americans who
Yep.
came of age during the Great Depression and World War II and the New Deal. I think a lot of us saw the Ken Burns special recently on the war, right? Think how that generation got started. A very unique life story, unlike Americans older and unlike Americans younger. The silent generation. Actually, the name was given by the historian William Manchester in the 1950s. Those are Americans who were born from the mid-1920s to the early 1940s.
And that's where my dad fits in. He's right in there.
He's right there. These are Americans who were the children of World War II and the Great Depression. They were born just too late to be heroes, you know, wartime heroes, and just too early to be free spirits during the 1960s, right? They came of age in the late 40s and 50s, the presidencies of Truman and Eisenhower and John Kennedy, and they have a very interesting life cycle. Of course, very risk-averse when they were young. Fortune magazine had a cover story in 1949 called The College Class of 49, Taking No Chances. You know, their first questions on job interviews were about pension plans, right?
Exactly.
But they wanted that long-term focus. They got their careers and they planned their lives at an early age. They also got married and had kids earlier on average than any other generation in our America, in our nation's history, which may explain the midlife crisis they had later on in the 70s and the divorce revolution they started later on.
And they loved staying with the same company
Absolutely.
For 20 years, 30
Absolutely.
Years.
And if you go back and look at the early 1960s, when Fortune magazine had stories about, you know, the brightest American businessmen under age 40, they were all vice presidents of big corporations, you know, Westinghouse and Ford Motor Company. If you take a look today at Fortune stories, they call it the top 40 under 40. Of course, these are all Gen Xers today, right?
Right, right.
They're all entrepreneurs who started their own business. I mean,
that's right.
That's how much that's how far we've gone. Another great example of a generation, great, may be the wrong word, but certainly glorified, is the boomers. We define boomers born 1943 to 1960. We push them back slightly from the fertility rate definition that the census has always given them. Because
a lot of us are right in that circle, too.
Well, that was a very interesting time. Of course, we were the silent generation, came of age during the American High. We boomers were the children of the American High. We have no memory of World War II. We were the children, the beaver cleavers of the 50s, and we came of age as the, you know, the long-haired radicals and Vietnam grunts and inner-city rioters of the late 60s and 70s. And then the early 1980s, you remember the famous yuppie.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly into family values and cocooning and very perfectionist ideas of our career. It was not necessarily related to where we were working. It was a very self-defined notion of a mission in our lives, an inward turn among that generation. And boomers, you know, they've been celebrated by the media all their lives. No phase of life means anything until boomers have experienced it and can tell other generations all about it. I think that's how it works. But they're a very interesting generation because they came of age spearheading a period of cultural revitalization, a real religious awakening in America. America has been through many of these periods of kind of cultural and values rebirth. And we can come back to that because that's actually important in generating changes in the social mood. Another generation that we all know about, again, another location in history, is Generation X. We define Xers born roughly between 1961 and 1981. And they, of course, you know, silent as kids were very protected. Boomers were increasingly indulged. And by the time Xers came along, childhood was totally unprotected. You know, childhood sank to the very bottom of society's priorities. Mm-hmm. And there was a real anti-child animus. You know, when Xers were growing up, there was, you know, schools no longer seemed to work. Families were breaking up. Opinion polls showed that people didn't want to stay together anymore for the sake of kids. And I don't know if you recall back in the 60s and 70s, that 20-year run of Child as Devil horror movies. You remember all that? The
Exorcist, yeah, absolutely.
And Rosemary's Baby and Damien and Omen. And this was the most profitable genre of Hollywood movie for 20 years. A horrible image of childhood. And all of those movies, you remember the Kramer versus Kramer sort of throwaway kids. And the Tatum O'Neill and Paper Moon. These were tough, hard kids. You didn't want to hug these kids. And it's very interesting because at that time, this was actually on purpose, because at a time when older people were discovering themselves, it was thought the best way to raise kids was to have kids raise themselves too, right?
Yeah.
So if they have a problem, you give them a latchkey guide, a self-care guide. This is important because in our business, employers sometimes come to us and they say, I don't understand. You know, a boomer manager will come to me and they say, I don't understand my Xer employees. They don't trust the system. They assume that no one's in charge. They go through life making temporary deals with people, and then they just keep moving on. And I have to explain, it's their location and history. If you want to explain why they have a free agent mentality, and they're always looking around the marketplace, you know, for a new opportunity, and they don't trust the system to take care of them, it's again, location and history. It's when they grew up. It's their earliest experiences. I was recently, just a few weeks ago, in an auditorium filled with, you know, millennial kids. These were high school kids. And I mentioned to them all something about latchkey kids, you know, latchkey children.
Yeah, yeah.
They all gave me a completely blank look, and one of them raised their hand, and they said, what's a latchkey kid? So every Xer knows what a latchkey kid is, right?
The so, millennials, huh?
Yeah, this is the next generation. They have no idea what that means. And millennials, of course, are the kids who've been born since the early 1980s, the X's remember the consciousness revolution as children, right? The boomers came of age during that period. But millennials were born after that was all over. So Woodstock to millennials is ancient history.
It really is.
It's like removed from them as the New Deal is from a boomer like myself.
I find it fascinating that my son, who's one of the millennials, he was born in 82. That's just when it starts.
Right.
That some of the music he listens to, he likes some of the older things that are old now that were pretty hip during my days. Yep. And I find this turnaround to be interesting, Neil. It's also funny for me because I look at a lot of young people today with their own clothes styles and their own music styles, and they like their video games. And in our own way, when we were that age, weren't we the same? We didn't have the technology, but we did other things. We wore our clothes that our parents didn't like. We had longer hair our parents didn't like.
Well, you know, actually, George, we did a lot more things our parents didn't like than these kids do.
That's true.
Let's be honest. We have actually looked at surveys, and we've done our own surveys on this. Today's kids have fewer problems with their parents. Today's teenagers have fewer problems with their parents. If you ask questions like, do you have any problems with your parents? Do you mind living with your parents? Do you trust your parents to solve your biggest problems? We find today's teens are closer to their parents than any other teens since the late 1950s, since we started asking these questions.
Really? Closer to
their
parents?
There's a complete disappearance of the values and culture gap between teens and parents today. When I go around traveling, I ask people in every audience I go to of the iPod overlap in your family. So if you're in your 50s, how many songs on your iPod are on your teen's iPod and vice versa? You know what a typical answer I get?
What?
25% to 30%, same song.
That's pretty interesting.
Now, I graduated high school in 1969. We did not have iPods back then, but I guarantee you the overlap would have been absolute zero, all right? There would not have been a single song on there that our parents, if it had gotten on my iPod, I would have desperately erased it.
That's fascinating.
We find that the teens today confide with their parents on issues of their career, confide on issues of fashion. The music today is derivative of 60s music. A lot of the songs are just, you know, warmed over old hits. The half the movies are derived from old movies. And millennials are okay with that. They don't crave the same authenticity in their culture that boomers did when we were young. And that actually says something important about how this generation is different. And, you know, each generation, George, and this is important, each generation turns a corner on the generation before. It's fundamentally different, and it always comes as a surprise. The generation is never a continuation of what came before.
Isn't that healthy, though?
Absolutely healthy.
Yeah.
It's essential for to equilibrate and to correct for the excesses of the generation in power.
I'm going to talk with you about the fourth turning prophecy next hour, Neil, because it is riveting. But tell me about the fourth turning. What does that mean?
Well, the fourth turning, let me just explain turnings and how it's related to generations. We have found that in history, certainly in American history, and it seems as though many other societies, particularly in the developed world that we've seen, go through certain rhythms in their history. And we've identified, just as we've identified four basic types or almost archetypes of generations, we find that these generations come of age and reach certain, you know, phases of life in four different kinds of social moods, right, that accompany each of these, the arrival of each of these new generations. The first turning, and each of these lasts about 20 to 22 or 23 years. You can imagine this whole thing maybe taking 80 or 90 years to complete. But the first turning is what we call a high, which is a period when institutions are strong and individualism is weak. Society is confident about where it wants to go collectively, even if, you know, many groups outside the mainstream feel shut out. This would, of course, be, in modern American history, an example of that would be the American high, right after World War II.
Right.
This is a time where we all felt greater than the sum of our parts. You know, we trusted big institutions. And we've had earlier periods like that in our history, the Victorian high of industrial progress and the middle class bourgeois family of the post-Civil War era, the era of good feelings after the America was founded, back in the 1810s and 20s. The next turning, the second turning, we call an awakening. This is a period when suddenly, just when society seems to be reaching its peak of public progress and prosperity, institutions are attacked in the name of personal and spiritual autonomy. Everyone wants to regain some sense of personal authenticity, and they're attacked in the name of higher values and historically in the name of religion. And this attack is always spearheaded by the generation coming of age. Of course, in the late 1960s and 70s, this was the boomer generation, right, which is out in the forefront of that movement. And we date this period, the second turning in America, from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s, from the campus revolts to the tax revolts. We can't forget that an awakening is a period of throwing off social obligations and political obligations, not just in the culture, which we remember from the 60s, but also in the economy, deregulation, tax cuts. Let's just all be more individualistic about everything. And this is typical of earlier awakenings in our history. We have had many of them. Many historians actually consider the consciousness revolution to be America's fourth or fifth great awakening. You know, depending on when you want, you start your count with Jonathan Edwards in the 1740s or John Winthrop in the 1630s. I mean, we have had a series of these movements, always associated with a very particular kind of generation coming of age.
What causes the movements, the turning, some event? Or
what causes it is the kind of generations that are alive at the time. In the second turning, you had a war veteran generation, a very civic generation, much associated, identified, and trusted the institutions they built, right? The GI, the World War II veteran.
Absolutely.
And this new indulged generation was raised to be free thinkers. GIs built all these universities, and they told boomers, we've been working all our lives. We don't understand what it all means. You boomers, go and study and be smart and tell us why we did what we did. Well, boomers did just that. And the answer is horrified, right, to the GIs that built all these institutions. But there is a tendency of the coming-of-age generation to be a corrective, to be sort of the yin and yang to the midlife generation in power. The midlife generation in power in the late 1950s, what was the biggest problem in America for them at the height of their power, late 50s, early 1960s? It was books like The End of Ideology, Too Much Conformity, Ticky-Tacky Houses. Everything was technique. No one thought about essential questions. Remember, 1984 was the book that horrified and scared everyone?
Mr. Orwell.
Well, boomers solved all those problems, right? We were the answer to the GI's fears. The GIs fought collectivism all their lives. They fought the fascists. They fought the communists. And they worried that they themselves were a little collectivist. And these boomers totally solved that problem. So that finally, by the year 1984, when boomers were taking over, Apple had that famous ad. You remember? 1984 won't be like 1984 with that guy smashing the tell screen, right? And it goes, and all the automatons wake up, right? Well, that's the story of the boomer generation, and it's happened again and again through history. These post-crisis babies play a very interesting role in our history. Now the third turning. The third turning.
Hold on, the third turning when we come right back, Neil. Neil Howe, this is fascinating. Neil's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, called thefourthturning.com. We'll be right back. Quite a week here in St. Louis. First of all, tonight I had an opportunity to go down to the beautiful Fox Theater and see ZZ Top play Billy Gibbons, Dusty Hill, Frank Beard. And those guys put on one heck of a program. And then after the concert was over, Billy was telling me how we'd like to relay a story to you on Ghost to Ghost Halloween night. And he was starting to tell me a little bit about it. And it was an incredible ghost story from Billy Gibbons at ZZ Top. And then, of course, here in St. Louis on Thursday will be the vice presidential debates between Mr. Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. And that's going to be a fascinating debate. Of course, I had an opportunity to pick which one I wanted to go to, so I took the ZZ Top concert, of course. I'll always be able to watch the debate on television. But we'll talk about that on Thursday when that time comes. In a moment, we'll be right back with Neil Howe, the fourth turning on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're talking with Neil Howe. He's one of two authors, William Sanders, his other William Strauss, his other co-author of The Fourth Turning. Neil, you were just ready to get into the third turning when the break hit.
Yes. The third turning is what we call an unraveling. And this is in many ways the opposite of a high, because of the third turning, institutions are weak and distrusted. And, of course, individualism is strong and flourishing. And, you know, a high follows a crisis. And, of course, the lesson of a crisis is that everyone has to, you know, coalesce and unite and build, right? That's what we did after World War II. The awakening teaches the opposite lesson, which is that the most important thing to do is to kind of atomize and be an individual and enjoy. And in many ways, that's what we do in an unraveling. To see earlier unravelings, you know, you can look back at the decades of the 1920s or the 1850s, the 1760s. These were all decades of cynicism and bad manners. Civic authority felt weak. Social disorder felt pervasive. The culture felt exhausted. Individual life felt frenetic. And this is, of course, kind of America of the last couple decades, right? That's kind of what we're describing.
Sure.
It's interesting. I travel around. I always go in bookstores, and you always go in a bookstore today. You find that the happiest and most upbeat books are books about me, myself, and I, right? And how I can remake myself, and I'm just an incredible person. And
all the most downbeat
books, all the most downbeat books today are books about what we have in common. You know, it's the end of society, the end of the family, the end of community, right? Well, that's a third turning, and history teaches that third turnings invariably end in a fourth turning, which is what we call a crisis. This is an era in which institutional life is torn down and rebuilt from the ground up, almost always in response to a perceived threat to the nation's survival. And if history doesn't produce a threat like that, some fourth turning leader will find one. Or, you know, create one in order to mobilize collective action.
And we've and it's cyclical, right?
And it's cyclical. I mean, this is what happens after the third turning. And as a certain kind of leader that we usually associate, it's typically the prophet archetype, right? Boomers entering old age. The generation born right after one crisis invariably is entering old age, presiding over the next crisis. And we've seen that. You know, time and again, the leaders of America during World War II and the New Deal was the generation born right after the Civil War. This is the missionary generation of Stimson and Marshall and MacArthur and FDR. The generation that presided over the Civil War was the transcendental generation. This was Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis and Emerson and Longfellow and all those guys, and on. I mean, you could go back to find the same pattern earlier. In these eras, civic authority revives, cultural expression refines a community purpose, often in the form of propaganda. You know, in World War II, Hollywood went to work for the government, and people began to locate themselves as pieces of a group again. We saw this in the 1930s, you know, the great decade of community and belonging, when everyone, you know, and FDR invented all these acronyms that everyone wanted to belong to, and community started coalescing again after the 1920s. And this is typically what we find in these crisis eras. Families begin to become more important in people's lives. You remember all those Frank Capra movies in the 1930s?
Oh,
those
It's a Wonderful Life,
big,
right?
Big multi-generational houses, right? And in each case, a fourth turning turns out to be a new founding moment in our nation's history, and it redefines their national identity. This was certainly true of the New Deal in World War II. It was true of the Civil War, the American Revolution, the Glorious Revolution. I mean, you can go back throughout history, and you see that these are, let me put it this way, a second turning and awakening is when we redefine and recreate our inner world, our cultural and values world. And a fourth turning is when we rebuild our outer world, our institutional world, our science and our social infrastructure. And we've seen this pattern, and what's interesting to us is its relationship, both shaping and being shaped by these different kinds of generations we've described.
Will there come a time where the cycle gets broken, Neil, and what has happened in the past won't happen in the future, and we've got to really adjust?
There's nothing, and I don't believe in determinism. There has been at least one anomaly in American history when the Civil War cycle failed to produce a civic generation, or what we call a hero archetype. The United States, though, has been rather amazing for its extreme cyclicality. I think in Europe and some of the other countries, you find more cases of sort of interrupted cycles. Yeah, it's a catastrophe in history that turns out horribly, or in some odd, and goes in an odd direction, can distort this. We're not determinists. We don't believe everything has to happen this way. We do, however, think that there's a tendency for history, for these kinds of moods to follow each other, and this tendency is driven by these different kinds of generations which are created. Boomers in old age, you know, these old Aquarians which we see around us, in Congress, they can't even agree on they can't agree on anything. Totally gridlocked, the culture wars, this red zone, blue zone. I mean, this is like Congress was on the eve of the Civil War. Fights broke out in the middle of Congress back there. There was a caning. A guy was practically died in a very, very celebrated case back in the 1850s. The same kind of generation entering old age. This was not a civic generation. This was a prophet archetype. And when they get old, they get zealous, they get righteous. And we see that in boomers, and they tend to take the country into these crisis-like situations. When you have leaders who are strong in their values orientation, it's hard to compromise over values, right? Now, if you believe you're right and someone else believes you're wrong, the generation which comes of age at this time is the new hero archetype. And we actually identify the millennial generation as an early instance of a new hero archetype, and a generation whose strength will be very different from the boomers.
And the clock, in terms of the length of the generation, the cycle, you say, is what, 20 years on the average?
About 20 years is the same as the length of a generation. So, for example, each of these turnings is associated with the coming of age of a generation. The World War II and the New Deal was the coming of age of the GI generation. The first turning, the American High, was the coming of age of the silent generation, right? The second turning, the consciousness revolution, this was the coming of age of boomers. And the third turning, which is, I don't know, the great boom and culture wars, whatever you want to call it, the sort of 80s and late 80s and 90s, this was Gen X coming of age, right?
Yeah.
A deregulated free agent society, and Gen X has excelled at it. And in each of these cases, the generation coming of age in some ways defines the mood of that era. Just as boomers defined the 60s and 70s with their culture and with Woodstock and with rock and roll, Gen X has defined the last couple of decades with their culture, with hip hop and their sort of free market orientation and their sort of pragmatism and their orientation to the bottom line.
Has the computer age accelerated any of this?
It doesn't accelerate it, because what determines a generation is how old you were when something happened. Let me put it this way. If there's a sudden change in the mood of let's take an example, Pearl Harbor Sunday, okay? So suddenly everything is different overnight. Now, how you are influenced by that event is going to depend critically on how old you are. If you are a child, everyone's going to tell you, get out of the way, stay quiet, stay safe, right? That's going to be your role.
Exactly.
Be dutiful, stay safe. But if you're just old enough, if you're just over a certain age, your role is going to be very different. Rise up, train, join the army. We got a war to fight. And that actually pretty much defined the boundary between the silent generation and the GI generation, if you look at it age-wise. So a change in the social mood influences people differently according to their age, because different social roles are expected at different ages, and that's how generations are created.
You know, with these boomers, which is what I am and you are, what happens to us when we get to a certain point? And again, we'll talk about the prophecy of this next. Is there anything, I mean, who is the one who's going to be the group that fights back, that changes some of the things that we're into now and that we will be faced with soon? Will it be us, the boomers, or will it be the X generation folks? The millennials are too young, I think. 82, they're only in their 20s.
Well, each generation, I mean, if you think of the fourth turning, and, you know, if you looking at sort of the aftermath of 9/11, and particularly what is now being called, you know, the financial crisis of 08, what we've just seen over the last week, we can see a palpable shift in the mood in this decade, both domestically and sort of geopolitically. And we think of our, you know, the dangers and obligations we have around the world. I think they've taken a darker tone than they took coming out of the 80s and 90s. And I think this is a sign we're entering this new era. This new era is going to last about a generation. It's going to last the next 20 years. It's going to last until the millennials are totally filled, you know, they totally occupy young adulthood all the way up to the edge of midlife. So that's the era. Much will happen over the next 20 years, right?
Can you have a fifth turning?
What?
Can you have a fifth turning?
I don't know. The only thing I can imagine after a crisis that ends well would be a first turning. I mean, people tire out and they want to sort of solidify and consolidate, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to know where else you go other than an endless crisis, perhaps. But in any event, each generation is going to be moving into a new phase of life over the next 20 years. Boomers will be retiring and entering old age. They will be occupying the very highest positions of political leadership. The silent generation is going to be pushed totally beyond the leadership age, except maybe in the Supreme Court and so on. They're no longer going to be the mediators and conciliators and compromisers. You're just going to have these scorched earth boomers, you know, filling that elder role. The Generation X is going to be completely filling midlife over the next 20 years. They will be the on-the-spot managers. They will be the generals. They will be the people actually making the critical decisions. And they're probably a good generation to be in that role because they're pragmatic. They're efficient. They're oriented to the bottom line. They're not hung up on, you know, principles and ideologies. This is probably a good generation to be in that role in the middle of a crisis. And then you're going to have millennials, this new generation of young adults, who will be the workers, the soldiers. I mean, whatever role they're called upon to fill, the national service recruits, right? And they will exercise what is turning out to be their strength, which is teamwork, which is community building. And if we have time, we should probably stop and at some point and just talk a little bit about this millennial generation. Because,
okay, yeah, sure, we've got some time.
They are showing some incredible civic strengths, which ought to be noted.
All right, now, how so? I mean, what are they doing?
Well, the highest community service rates that we've seen in the post-war era. Community service and service learning, it's almost expected, for instance, of kids going into college, that everyone will do some kind of community service. Back when Gen X was in college, community service was a punishment. I mean, you remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe also, though, Neil, maybe there aren't enough jobs out there. Maybe they have to do community service.
Well, that will accentuate it. That will accentuate it. We write actually a lot of books about millennials. We write books to colleges. We've consulted for all the branches of the military on millennials, how they're being recruited differently. We're very close to this generation, certainly the survey data. I'll tell you one interesting survey that Universum Communications has done. This is a survey of exiting college seniors, comparing 2000 versus 2007, so it's kind of late wave Xers versus, of course, millennials today, in their answers to the question, what name your favorite employers, the employers you'd most want to work for after college. In 2000, top 10 were all for-profit corporations. Remember back then, it was Accenture and Cisco and all those companies.
Yeah, exactly.
Today, five of the top 10 are either government agencies or nonprofits. FBI, CIA, Peace Corps, Teach for America,
dramatic.
Those five. Incredible. Employers say that young people now coming to work for them, they want to know that their business and their organization is serving some public purpose. We see rising voter participation rates among the young ever since the year 2000, continually going up. And we expect absolutely record rates. We already saw the scene in the primary, and we're going to see record rates in 2008 of young people voting. This is reversing the trend that boomers started with unplugging from the system, right?
Is it true that every civilization thought that they were in end times, and that could very well be the reason for these turnings, that the turnings were there 2,000 years ago?
Well, they actually, it's a good question. We've identified certain elements as turnings, crises followed by spiritual awakenings, even back in the classical Greek and Roman world, when one could argue that they went through some of these same cycles, sort of cultural change and military or geopolitical crisis. But they certainly are very vivid today. Modernity helps the formation of generations because for generations to have an impact, people have to be free to sort of change institutions according to their generational personality, right? And then so their kids could sort of change it back. And that kind of fluidity, that kind of freedom in a totally traditional society where all roles are prescribed, it's very hard to have meaningful generational change. You know, everyone's sort of forced into the same mold every year. But you certainly see it, and I don't think it's any accident that Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s was already talking about American generations. He said, in a democracy like America, every generation is born new, he said, and reshapes the country according to its purposes. And I think that Tocqueville, of course, coming from France, coming from the old world, noticed this very early. I think that more and more countries around the world are showing some of these same trends.
Well, let me tell you, you and William Strauss did a great job putting this all together. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Bill, sadly, I should mention that Bill passed away.
Oh, no.
Yes, this last December. He had a 6 or 7 year fight with pancreatic cancer, which he lost, of course. 6 or 7 years is pretty good.
Absolutely.
For that diagnosis. But he was an amazing guy. Each of the two of us have separate careers. My other career has always been sort of a budget analyst, an economist, and demographer here in D.C. His other career was a musical guy. He was founders of the Capitol Steps, which is the, you know, sort of comedian Washington group, which has several different casts, and they put on, I don't know, hundreds of performances a year around the country.
When we come back, tell us about how the partnership grew between you two, and also we'll get into the fourth turning, the prophecy. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.